to a Zen monk and a professor walk into a bar. Now, here are your hosts, Zen monk Eric Daishin McCabe and Professor Douglas Gentile.
Welcome, dear listener, to our show. I'm Doug Gentile. I'm a professor of psychology.
My name's Daishin McCabe, and I'm a Soto Zen Buddhist priest.
Wow. So this is the first of our shows here, and I think people would want to know, why should they listen to us? Why should we listen to us?
I don't know, but it feels really good to say something.
So action is an important thing, you know, not just pondering over things, but actually taking some action. Mm. And so I think the way I think of this show is we're asking the questions that matter. We're going to ask across many, many weeks questions about, you know, what's the meaning of life? Mm. Where does that meaning come from? What do different religions have to say about it? Why are we here? Who are we anyway? What makes us who we are? How can we live what Aristotle might have called the good life? And I think, you know, these are questions everyone has.
Yeah, I think we all have them down deep. We may not get a lot of opportunities to think about them unless something really big happens to us.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Did you, like, have these types of questions when you were a little kid?
No, but I do remember, this is one thing I remember when I was, actually, I think little kids probably have a much deeper understanding or sense of the kind of ultimate mystery of things than adults do. And then as we grow up and as we get more mature, our brain tends to harden over, tends to calcify a little bit. But I remember when I was 10 years old and I was looking down at the sidewalk. I was kind of playing between a sidewalk and a paved road in my just right outside of my parents' home in Maryland. And I looked really closely at the asphalt, at the road itself, and I started thinking about, and again, this, I was only 10 years old. I started thinking about how this one spot connects to every road in the United States.
Hmm.
Like this one spot here connects to, I mean, anywhere I go, I can go anywhere. And if I was in a car,
you could get
every road would be connected through asphalt to right here where I am at right now. And you know, I thought at the time nobody guided me to that awareness or understanding, and I thought at the time that was I felt a sense of amazement that, wow, how is that?
Hmm.
And I didn't really say anything about it to my parents or anybody because I didn't think, I just thought it was interesting.
Sure.
You know, I thought it was really interesting. So I think that kids, especially when they're, you know, they're younger, they have that sense of amazement. Halloween this last week, we had a young girl come to the house with her family, and she's, as I opened the screen door, she noticed a moth on the screen door. She was maybe about, I would say, 2.5 feet tall, and she pointed at the butter, she called it a butterfly.
Uh-huh.
And she was just astonished by the butterfly that was attached to the screen. And so, and just put a smile on her face. If it was if it was an adult, me or you, I don't think we would have had the same reaction because we've already had so many associations with that we're not as easily able to enter into that sense of newness with something as simple as a moth on a screen.
Hmm.
We've labeled it, we've had some previous experience with it, and we think we know what it is. And that prevents us from actually, like that little girl, saying, wow, look at that moth. And she turned away for an instant, and the moth flew away. And then she turned her head back, and she said, oh, where'd it go? And she was so disappointed that it was gone. Huh. She was more interested in the moth than she was in getting a piece of candy.
So is that what, you know, Zen talks about as beginner's mind?
Yeah, that's what we call beginner's mind. The mind of a there's a saying by Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, one of the earliest Zen masters to come to the United States from Japan, who is known to say that in the expert's mind there are few possibilities, but in the beginner's mind there are many, mm-hmm. and that we should always strive to attain or to have our beginner's mind in whatever it is we're doing.
Now, do you see that as the same as what Jesus said about you need to become like a child to enter the kingdom of God?
To me, I don't see any difference in those two kinds of teachings. Hmm. I think Jesus was saying the same thing. I think he was saying that, at least in that case.
Sure,
that's an intersecting point. That's where two paths intersect.
Now, it's interesting that you had that insight at age 10. At age 10, for me, I believe I was going to a Dutch Reformed Protestant church in Buffalo, New York. And the minister was going to have one Sunday, he just had people fill out questions. You could ask him any question about religion or doctrine and the next week he would answer all these questions. And even as, you know, a 10-year-old, I kind of had an analytical, scientific mind. Mm-hmm. And so my question was, how does Jesus dying on a cross take away my sins? Uh-huh. Something he did 2,000 years ago. How does that actually influence mine? And I have no memory of what he actually said. My memory is whatever he said, I found it really disappointing and didn't answer the question. So perhaps that's what has propelled me all these years to keep asking questions, because my first time I step up to the plate and say, here's a question. I went, that didn't answer my question, man. I want more.
Yeah. And for some people, a solid answer might feel satisfactory. But I think you're bringing up a good point, is that for other people like yourself, this was just, it wasn't satisfactory to whatever answer that came was not satisfying to your soul or to the core of your being. It just, you know, you answered a very sincere and innocent question, and maybe kind of getting right to the heart of Christian faith, mm-hmm. that this kind of belief that Jesus died for your sins because he was innocent, so he couldn't die for his own sins. He died for others' sins, even up into the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so you want to, from a logical perspective, from a rational perspective,
makes no sense.
It doesn't make sense, right? Yeah, it doesn't make sense. But from a faith perspective, it's different.
Yeah,
it could make sense.
The first time I actually understood that doctrine at what I felt was a truly satisfying way was I was dating a girl who wanted me to kind of share the same faith the same way she did. And so, so she had me reading all sorts of things that helped to explain it. And the single best book I think I've ever read on these things is Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And it did a fantastic job of actually explaining the logic of that idea in a way I've never heard anyone ever do. Yeah. So it's not that it can't make sense to me, but it took a particular person who could break it down into a way that made sense to me.
Yeah, and I think you're making an important point here, because I think that in in seminary, for example, from what I understand, I guess I have to be careful here because I haven't been to seminary, but from what I understand is that there is this marriage between faith and reason, and that actually reason, traditionally, in whether it's the Christian faith or the Jewish faith or the Muslim faith, has been used to demonstrate the need for or the existence of God or the reasons for having faith in a higher being. I can think of theologians who went through to exhaustive extents to logically show the reasons behind a particular faith, whether it's belief in the Trinity or belief in God.
Or in belief in rebirth, certainly in the Tibetan Buddhist approach, they do this whole logical backflipping to try to show logically that this is necessary.
Right.
And I've never been convinced by that either.
And reason is it seems to be like a two-edged sword, because it can be used to somehow prove the need for faith, but it also could be used to prove the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we don't actually need faith, or that whatever faith belief there might be may not actually be logical.
Mm-hmm. So you've told me before, you grew up Catholic, and you know from your starting place on the asphalt, you know, what got you into a Zen temple, and you know, and where you were for what, 14 years?
15 years, yeah. Well, as a growing up Catholic, my father for me has been kind of the symbol or the representative of logic. Mm-hmm. He's a mechanical engineer, and he demonstrated throughout my childhood the use of the rational mind to think problems through. He was really good himself at math and science, and I always deeply admired and respected him for his great knowledge in those subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was kind of this other, she's the balance of say faith or maybe devotion, bhakti in the Hindu sense, but she's, you know, a devout Catholic. And she, you know, there's a, this great, which her name, Prudence, it means wisdom. And that she would often, it was funny, my father would use kind of long logic to explain something, and then my mother would just cut to the chase and say, you know what, this is, you know, and you could see her beauty come out there, and her wisdom really oftentimes shone through. And she didn't have any special training in logic, and she didn't really necessarily need it.
Right, right.
And she worked with little kids, so she came from a very deeply intuitive place. I don't even think she recognized how intuitive she was, but, or maybe she did, I don't know, it doesn't matter. But both of them, one was this very intuitive, could kind of see things clearly without having to think them through or find empirical evidence. Mm-hmm. The other was, or is, somebody who wanted to see proof of everything before he would kind of accept it.
Right, right.
So that's the kind of family that I grew up in, and there was considerable tension all of the time between them, and they, you know, but they very clearly love each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
in a sense, they completed each other. One's mostly head and the other's mostly heart.
Exactly. I mean, that's a good way. Yeah, they really did need it. I mean, and they were so complimentary. I don't give them enough credit, I think, sometimes for that. But for me, you know, I felt like with my great grandmother was from Sicily. She came to the United States when she was 13, and she didn't speak much English. She spoke maybe five words, and we would go and visit her over holidays in Brooklyn, New York, drive up from Maryland, and she was always such a joy to be around, even though we couldn't understand what she was saying. just a little Sicilian lady and kind of heavy set, but she would always be praying a rosary, or at least once a day she'd be praying a rosary. And her face showed this such kind of sense of devotion and concentration, you know, sense of really concentrated on what she was doing, really focused on the mysteries of the rosary. And she wasn't able to communicate her faith with words, but she was with her with the way that she expressed herself.
Man, that's bodily. So powerful.
Yeah. So I think it had more of an effect on me than I realized, and I didn't realize it more until I was in college studying world religions and feeling somewhat batted around by these different truths and off-center, off-base, that I came to see. I really felt the need for something. And I was so turned off by this idea of God, because I felt like this concept of God, now for me at that time in my life, this concept of God had really, I felt somewhat betrayed by it. I felt like it wasn't the real God.
Mm.
And I felt like I was out of touch with not only reality, but with God as mm-hmm. well. And the name, the word God, just didn't help me to reconnect with God, if right. you know what I
sure,
mean.
Sure, sure.
So for me, that was at a pivotal time, and it's when I met my Zen teacher, Diane Banaj. And what impressed me about her so much was she had a physical sense of, how do I say that? There was a physicalness, or like a...
She embodied it the way your grandmother did.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. But even more so.
Oh,
I mean, my great grandmother
practiced
did.
Doing that.
My great grandmother really did. But my teacher was, I don't know how to say it. She just complete embodiment of truth. Mm-hmm. Now I hesitate to say that too loudly, because it sounds almost. And she also, as I began to study with my teacher, I realized too that there is no such thing as a perfect human being, mm-hmm. no matter how much we want to deify them. And I say that with utmost respect. I mean, that's generally, it's very natural for human beings. And I think this is why we benefit from having a teacher. It's very natural for us to look up to somebody and to want to be like that person. We see sure. some attributes sure, and sure. I want to be like that person. And we devote ourselves to learning from them and wanting to understand as much as we can from that person. And in the course of that, we realize, hey, wait a minute, they're just like me. And maybe I don't have to, and it's not just something you just get. It says this is a process. And instead of trying to be like them, then somewhere the mirror turns around and we realize, oh, wait a minute. It's really, I have to be more of who I am, not try to be like somebody else. So that's a gift to me of a discipleship or of an apprenticeship, mm-hmm. is we become more of ourselves. And yet we know that we can't do it without some guidance, without a teacher that can kind of show us more of the path that's in front of us, like little angles here we didn't think of mm-hmm. prior to that.
Yeah, I remember Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan, kind of American Tibetan Buddhist monk, you know, was asked, you know, do you need a teacher? And his answer was no, but it really helps.
Yeah. 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 And I think for Catholics, I can't speak for all Christians, all Christians, but for, I think for Catholics, that comes in the form of a priest sure. for many.
Sure.
The priest plays that role to some extent, as does the community or the elders in the community or one's parents as they practice their faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just for spiritual matters, it's for anything.
No, it happens at the university. I certainly, you know, there are yeah. students that, you know, for whom I end up being an important mentor to, and the funny thing is, half the time I don't even know that's happening.
You know, that's yeah.
But they come back years later. Oh, you were so important to me. You changed my life in this way or that. And it's know, so many of these relationships, some of them can be very formal, but they don't have to be. Mm-hmm. Well, where, you know, I grew up on the other side of the Catholic-Protestant divide, mm-hmm. Being raised mostly Lutheran with a little jaunt over into the Dutch Reformed, and then my mother married a Lutheran minister. And so I grew up actually within the church then. And so the Missouri Synod, which is almost the most conservative branch of the Lutheran Church, I tend to think of them as the ultimate failed Catholics. they're very, you know, basically they just gave up guilt. Mm-hmm. That's it. But everything else is pretty much the same. And we don't have, you know, a whole lot of decoration on our walls. He gave up guilt and, you know, and fashion. But, and I remember, you know, for me growing up then, you know, kind of seeing the behind the scenes, being really repelled by so much of it, unfortunately, that I started seeing that most of the people in this church have never read the document that they claim to believe in. They just cherry pick a couple little verses that they like, but really they don't know what it says. Mm-hmm. And that most of what happens in here is about ego-based politics. Mm. They want it to look this way because that will make them look good. And it had nothing to do with God. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a teenager just being so disillusioned that, you know, these people who are coming together specifically, you know, with this mission, right, of sharing in a community of God and a community of belief and faith and support, are sitting there attacking each other all day long because they will want it to be this way or they want it to be that way. You know, my favorite religious joke of all time is, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? The answer is all of them, half of them to do it, and the other half to say they liked the old one better. Because, yeah, you know, I remember the battles over just changing the hymnal and how, they half of them are pushing it and half of them saying, no, I hate that, I want the old one. And finally, when I got to age 19, I had this realization that the only reason I believed what I believed is because someone had told it to me. And I thought, that's a terrible reason to believe something. I should have my own reasons. Mm. And so I did kind of that Descartesian thing where I said, well, I'm going to just doubt everything. Mm. I'm going to no longer believe anything. I'm going to start from the ground up. You know, and Descartes came up with, you know, I think, therefore I am. That was his grounding place. Mm-hmm. My grounding place was the one great universal is, don't hurt anyone. Mm. That everyone else has exactly the same rights that I do. And so the one universal truth that I could find at age 19 was, everyone else should not tread on mine and I should not tread on theirs. And that was the only truth at that point I could find. And so all other questions about religion, I put in the category of, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I became a devout agnostic for 15 or 20 years, during which time I read deeply in many world religions, until I started, you know, kind of finding things that started speaking to me and going, you know, pay attention, Doug, this one feels true. Mm. And having kind of, you know, because I guess throughout all my life, I've been a scientist. I need to see it for myself. Mm-hmm. And until I do, I'm not going to say it doesn't exist because, you know, the universe is much bigger than I can imagine. Just because I don't currently think that there's a personal God who is paying attention to what I'm doing at this moment doesn't mean there couldn't be. Mm-hmm. He just hasn't talked to me yet. And when he does, when I have that experience, then I will know that for myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other people who have that experience, that doesn't, you know, I can't negate that. Right. So, you know, that's their experience. And so my mother's always been kind of disappointed that I fell off, you know, what she sees as the right path. And at various times she's tried to reconvert me. And so she once, you know, told me one of, you know, kind of gave me her testimonial. She said, when I was getting divorced from your father, I had this dream. And in the dream, I was in a dark basement and stumbling around trying to find my way out. And I finally get over to where the stairs are and I look up at the top, and the door at the top of the stairs is cracked just a little bit. And from behind it is this brilliant white light. And so I'm going up the stairs, and as I near the top, a voice says to me, go out, take only what you need, and close the door behind you.
Mm.
And I knew that was God speaking to me, telling me, take the good from my marriage, leave the rest behind, and move on with my life. And I said to her, wow, what a powerful, important dream that was.
Mm.
And she said, no, that wasn't a dream. That was God speaking to me. And I said, wow, what a powerful, important dream that was. She says, no, you know, I couldn't have had that dream unless God gave it to me. I said, look, Mom, you can't expect me to believe in the Missouri Synod Lutheran God just because you had a dream. She said, yes, I can. I went, okay, fine. Yeah, you can. That's it. But I didn't have that dream.
Mm.
I'm not sure I'd interpret it the same way if I had had it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from that moment on in her life, she has had no doubt that there is a personal God who is paying attention to exactly what she's going through and will step in to help her if she needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And that totally revolutionized her life. She has lived her life in a completely different way from that moment. And that's what I think is absolutely beautiful about religion, is that it can transform us in these, you know, amazing, surprising ways. And that's her truth.
Yeah.
That is her capital T truth, I think, you know, from my perspective.
Yeah.
That doesn't make it my truth, and that doesn't make it wrong for her. But
exactly.
But wow, you know, that is absolutely a beautiful story.
Mm.
And I'm really glad she told it to me. I wish she wasn't doing it to manipulate me, but but okay, that's, you know, that's also part of her truth, right? That, you know, that she feels that's important to do. So she's being true to herself there too.
Mm.
And it's hard for me to be annoyed about that. That's, you know, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, a little bit about how we got to this radio show, I guess.
I think the question of, you know, who are we, and or maybe what are we doing here, is a kind of, it's just a great question to keep on the kind of on the back of our mind, in the back of our mind, and coming back to it. I get inspired just thinking about it, and it's that kind of spiritual nourishment that feeds me.
Mm.
It's my equivalent of there's the gospel story of where Jesus is at the well, and he tells the woman there that if you drink the water that I give you, you'll have eternal life. And I think that for me, that could be taken literally, and many people do, and that's fine, to mean a certain thing. And for me, that has meant that we need to have this kind of these dialogues, these kind of talks, feed our that part of us that is eternal, that part of us that's always been here, and just to kind of remember that is itself a kind of nourishment for our souls, or for our spirits, or however you like to.
Well, man does not live by bread alone. He
exactly.
Lives by radio shows too. So we hope you men and women and other genders will join us again next week.
Thank you so much for listening. Vows to all of you.
Professor is a production of KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and surrounding communities.